From KCRW, this is Greater LA. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis today, coming to you from Long Beach and Long Beach Harbor's crown jewel, the Queen Mary. This 94-year-old ship is named after Queen Elizabeth's grandmother, who was present for its public debut alongside much of the royal family way back when. And like its namesake, this vessel represented glitz, it represented glamour, and the high life during its tenure as one of the world's premier luxury ocean liners. When it was decommissioned and sold to Long Beach in 1967, it took on a new life as a dockside hotel, and in the more than half century since, the Queen has changed hands several times, now faces an uncertain future as it needs some costly repairs. Repairs that right now are being made, as a matter of fact. Some construction still going on. Joining us to discuss the history and the future of this elegant vessel is Diane Rush, historian and one-time president of the Queen Mary Foundation. Diane, thanks for leading us on this tour and bringing us down here.
Oh, thank you so much.
We also have our guide, the Commodore. And we're not talking about Lionel Richie. We're talking about the Commodore of this ocean liner. And Commodore, tell us your name.
My name is Commodore Everett Hoard.
What will you be telling us today?
Well, I'll give you some facts about the ship's history. I've been hanging around the Queen Mary now 42 years.
42 years.
And that's consumed most of my working life in one fashion or another. I've been Commodore of the ship for the past 11 years. One thing about the Queen Mary is that it is a vessel with such a compelling allure and such a vibrant history that it clings to your heart. And I've seen very few people ever cross this gangway that didn't leave a changed person.
Well, speaking of gangway, shall we cross it?
Absolutely.
All right. Diane, when was the Queen Mary built?
Well, in 1930 was when her keel was laid. That was December 27, 1930. And she was suspended for 2 years during the Great Depression. And after that, she was restarted in 1934. And then her maiden voyage was May 27, 1936. And from there, she had a 31-year career, longer than most of the other ships.
So, Commodore, where are we right now?
We are on the promenade deck, which is glass enclosed. This side of the promenade deck is 724 feet in length, and originally it circumnavigated the entire ship. But it was a lounging place for people to enjoy deck chairs and tea and beef bouillon and simply enjoy the sea air when the weather was too bad to be up on the sun deck.
So, Commodore, apparently not only is this an ocean liner, right, and a tourist attraction, but also it's a radio station?
It is a radio station. We do have a ham radio station on board. I believe it's called WRO6. It actually started on the last voyage of the Queen Mary. A fellow by the name of Nate Brightman got special permission. And then once the ship got opened up in the early 1970s, he started his onboard service, and the volunteer ham radio operators would talk to people all over the world.
Diane Rush, why do you think there are so many stories of hauntings on this ship?
I think wherever there is a place of strong emotional attachment, I think it somehow imprints itself on that space for all times.
And to be sure, Commodore, people have died on this ship, right, over the years, just over the course of time.
Yes, like any other piece of real estate on the earth today, people have come and gone on board the Queen Mary. But there is something more noticeable here. In such a well-loved place as the Queen Mary, why wouldn't we lose a little bit of ourselves when we come and experience her magnificent majesty?
A lot of famous people boarded this ship, right?
Absolutely. The Queen Mary carried the creme de la creme of the traveling public in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s as well. But this was Churchill's floating Whitehall during World War II. So many decisions regarding the D-Day invasion were decided right here in his cabin in the Queen Mary.
Wow. Diane, I mean, so they're fixing this up, right? But we know that it's gotten into some disrepair over the years, right?
Right.
And it's going to take a lot of money to fix it. What do you say to people who maybe point out that, you know, there are so many other problems, bigger problems than a boat that's, you know, 90 years old?
Well, one of the good things about something from history like this, it gives you reassurance that you can overcome anything, because the Queen Mary went through the Great Depression, World War II. She was a troop transport ship. And my dad was one
of
the...
Your dad? Your dad was on this boat?
Yes, he was one of the GIs transported during World War II. In 1944, in early June, he was transported in order to come over for the D-Day invasion. And he talked very much of his trip on the Queen Mary. He loved the idea that he could eat in the Grand Salon, which is a beautiful restaurant. That's where I got my enthusiasm.
Commodore, will you take us to the Grand Salon, if you don't mind?
I would be happy to take you to the Grand Salon.
Oh, it's a rope line. So we're approaching the Grand Salon.
Approaching the Grand Salon. And when the Queen Mary was completed in 1936, this was the largest room that had ever been installed in any vessel. The Grand Salon is three decks in height. So from the deck to the deckhead is about 32 feet. And these columns you see here are not just aesthetic, they are structural. Lots of artwork in here. The Queen Mary is a veritable floating art gallery. She's the largest collection of Art Deco in any one given place on the planet today.
Now that we've seen the Grand Salon, right, let's see how this ship really worked. Can you take us to sort of the guts of this place?
You want to see the business end of the Queen Mary.
I want to know how this ship cruised.
Yes, well, then I think that a trip down to the after engine room is definitely in order. There was enough electricity generated in the ship to light a city of 100,000. And now here we are at the very stairs.
We are descending.
We are descending into the hallows of the Queen Mary's Great Harbor. Let's go just down here and we'll have a little better look at all the different components. I want to first say that here in the engine room, you're living in the world of revolutions. Everything is about providing and creating those revolutions that will go out those four propeller shafts to those 32-ton propellers.
That will move this ship.
It will move this vessel forward. You've got all of this spinning going on. And by the time it gets out to the propellers, you know, they're spinning, what, three times a second, 172 RPM. With every revolution, that pushes the ship through the water 18 and a half feet, because that's the diameter of the propeller.
This is like modern Marvel technology of the time.
It was.
All this steam and the turbines right down here and the boilers that are a part of this process make the propellers move. Where are those?
Well, now there's just one of the four still attached to the
Really?
Queen Mary, but there's a special underwater box that's been built around it, and we're going to go there next, and I'm going to let Diane tell you all about it.
All right, it's dark in here. So we are, all right, so this is a bridge that's overlooking the water, where the propeller is immersed in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Diane Rush, when you look at this and you see how much of this is still intact and how much of this is, you know, the curiosity that's involved in all of this, what is the historical value of keeping this?
Well, I'll tell you how it was kind of illustrated to me. When I was traveling in Paris, I asked one of the curators, how do the Parisians go about maintaining the Eiffel Tower? As time goes on, it's continually being repaired at enormous cost. But he said, but it's the soul of Paris. So I would apply that toward the Queen Mary. Whatever it costs, whatever it takes, Queen Mary is the soul of Long Beach.
Diane Rush, Commodore Everett Horde, thank you so much for taking us on this tour and letting us see this beautiful place, this historic place.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Queen Mary is really something. It's an amazing piece of history, and it's been around for almost 90 years. As you heard, there's a lot of work happening on the ship and a lot more that still needs to be done, which of course costs money. And the debate goes on over just how much it's going to take and what the future of the ship should be there in Long Beach. Reporter Christy Hutchings has been covering it all for the Long Beach Press-Telegram. Christy, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You've been following the repairs and the reopening of the Queen Mary now. It's been closed since the pandemic, obviously. Mm-hmm. How many millions of dollars have gone into getting it sort of in order?
Well, it's a little bit of a complicated story. Back in 2021, the city gave the previous operator of the ship, which was called Urban Commons, they gave him about $21 million that was needed to do some critical repairs to the ship that, you know, had been kind of put off for a long time. As you said, the ship's been around for many, many years. So those repairs needed to be finished with that money, but an audit done by the city later found they were never completed. And that kind of shook up the whole situation over at the Queen Mary, and the Urban Commons ended up, you know, going bankrupt and forfeiting their lease, which brought it back into city control for the first time in nearly 40 years. So aside from that $23 million over the past couple of years, they've input about another, I'd say, $8.8 to $9 million to get the ship to where it is right now.
So, I mean, and when you talk about the dollar figure, right, so you're talking $23 million, the company went, you know, belly up, or obviously it didn't work out with that mm-hmm. operator of the Queen Mary, right? And now we're hearing anywhere between five and, what is it, $250 million that it's going to take to really get this thing in order? I mean, what does your reporting tell you? What numbers are right?
There are some really big numbers floating around, and that huge number, that $250 million, came from a study a few years ago that was done by like a third party, sort of laying out all the options that the city could take with the ship moving forward, how they wanted to handle it. So those $250 million was how much it would cost to, you know, if they wanted to sink the ship or take it out to sea or bring it, you know, on land or do something different with it. And that's really the top end of things. And from what I understand, that's not where the city is going with this. The realistic number is on the lower end. Like I said, that $23 million was pretty much the most amount that the city has spent on the ship recently. And as they've actually gotten into doing the repairs, it's been lower. And I think we're at the low end of $10 million here to really get everything fixed up and ready for the public.
I mean, how much will the public, I guess, you know, sit with this, the fact that the city spent so much money already and then have to put in $10 million more, right?
Right. Yeah. So there is, you know, some contention about the Queen Mary and the city giving this money to something that they deem to be kind of old, outdated, not really worth the money. But the good news is, for people who are worried about that, is the city has kind of gone out of their way to make sure that they're spending as few taxpayer dollars on this as possible. So the more recent money that, you know, $10 million, about half of that was made up from oil revenue funds. Another half was made up from filming permit revenue. They've allowed, you know, movie crews to keep coming on the ship and making movies throughout the three-year closure, and that's generated a lot of income for them. So they're able to use that instead of, you know, dipping into the general fund. And they've also recently launched something called it's the Queen Mary Membership Program, and they're going to use funds from that. It's like $150 a year for people who are in love with the Queen Mary and want to support it. That money is going to also help with the preservation of the ship long term.
There was also talk, Christy, that the ship wasn't safe. Is it safe?
It is safe now.
I felt safe. I felt safe on the boat.
Yes, it is safe now, definitely. I think there were concerns that the ship might sink. I think that's what everyone was thinking about, you know, a few years ago when all of this started happening. But, you know, they've been doing the repairs. They took off 20 really old lifeboats from the sides of the Queen Mary that had been on there for decades. Super heavy, putting about 100 tons of extra weight onto the Queen Mary that was really sort of messing with the structural integrity of the whole vessel. So taking those off was a really big milestone in the repairs. And they've been doing a lot of other little things around the ship to make sure that when people come on board, there's no concern that they're going to fall into the ocean.
I mean, there are a lot of people in Long Beach who love this boat, this large ocean liner. Is there enough favor for it, you know, that people love it so much that they just won't ever let this go?
Well, I can tell you that when the ship finally reopened for public tours, which was, I believe, on April 1st, it sold out pretty immediately. People were really excited to get back on board. I went on day one to go talk to people and interview them. And everyone who I talked to was really excited to be there, from families to tourists, from the neighboring cruise line. You know, everyone was having a really great time. And, you know, of course, there's always going to be people who aren't such a big fan, but I think what you're saying about the Queen Mary being a part of Long Beach's identity is very true, and that when you think about Long Beach, you think about the ship, and it's going to be hard to sort of move away from that.
Christy Hutchings of the Long Beach Press-Telegram. Christy, thanks for coming on and giving us some clarity on this.
Thanks for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The debates over abortion have dominated national headlines in recent months as states continue to respond to last summer's controversial U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade. California still has some of the strongest abortion protections in the country, but accessing abortion services remains a challenge for a lot of folks, especially in rural parts of this state. And now, threats to the legality of abortion pills could create even more barriers to care. In Los Angeles, a group of abortion doulas has been organizing to protect abortion access for people in California and beyond. Sarah Michal Hamid is a member of the Los Angeles Abortion Support Collective and joins us now to talk about their work. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
What exactly is an abortion doula? I mean, can you break down for us what it is that you do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So an abortion doula is someone that provides comfort, support, and advocacy for a person who is having an abortion, whether it be in their first, second, third trimester, whether it be because they have a health condition, whether it be because they simply want to terminate their own pregnancy. We support all people and all reasons.
How did the collective come to be? And you know, those services, with all those services that you offer, I mean, how did you sort of fine tune all of that?
I think in the state of California, because we have such strong legal protections for abortion, people think that access is something that would just naturally come with legal protections. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And so during the immediate aftermath of the Dobbs decision and the overturn of Roe v. Wade last year, a lot of concerned abortion doulas and advocates for reproductive health and justice came together, and we decided to start a collective, which is the Los Angeles Abortion Support Collective, and is the first of its kind that serves the entire Los Angeles County.
And what kind of services are we talking about here?
So we provide in-person and virtual support, and that can mean anything from attending an in-clinic procedure, going to a hospital, supporting someone from their home, supporting someone inside a different healthcare setting, cooking for them, helping them with any of the aftercare and the physical pain management, and just really being a safe space for someone to talk to have, and to hold their hand.
Yeah. Who are the clients, Sarah, that typically seek your help? I mean, are these folks coming from within LA, from within California, they're coming from other states?
We have a really diverse kind of clientele that we serve just because of the nature of Los Angeles. We provide care to people that live in LA County from very different communities. We also provide care to people that live in the state of California who have to travel to Los Angeles to obtain abortion care. And obviously, travel into the state from other states is a really big factor that this impending kind of mifepristone case would potentially impact.
Well, let's talk about mifepristone, which is the abortion drug. And I know California's implemented a lot of protections related to abortion, including enshrining a right to access it in its constitution. But some of these debates are, you know, creeping closer to home. How would a potential ban affect California if there is a national ban?
Right. Mifepristone is one of the medications that is commonly prescribed in the duo of medication abortion. So there is another medication called misoprostol, which also works to terminate early pregnancies. However, eliminating the availability of mifepristone would directly impact people's access in a manner that we don't really know the full scope yet, because it's so unprecedented to implement such a really bad regulatory ban on a medication that's been approved for 20 plus years. I mean, mifepristone's been available over, like, in the United States longer than I've been alive.
I don't know where you go from here. It's sort of uncharted territory, right? If you do something like that, because then you could, I mean, there are other drugs that you could attach that to as well.
Mm-hmm, like birth control. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. I mean, and I also looked, there are 58 counties in California, and I'm reading the striking statistic that what is it, about half or just under
40% half? 40% of them don't have a single operational abortion clinic.
So, I mean, why are there so few clinics in some areas? I mean, how are those folks affected by this court case?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they are affected tremendously by this court case and by ongoing attacks on the legal rights to reproductive health care, because the state of California and the University of California system have initiatives set forth to kind of further develop rural health care access in the state. And they often sign very, very, very large contracts with religious health organizations that do not permit abortion care from being provided, taught to residents, or even discussed in some cases. So we are funding the wrong institutions and we're funding the wrong clinics. And on the other hand, we have to unpack the very deep-seated history of the state of California when it comes to eugenics, when it comes to sterilization, and when it comes to attacks on people's reproductive health care. You know, in Los Angeles County, we used to have an abortion squad that was essentially a secret squad of the LAPD that would seek out abortion providers and abortion havers and criminalize them and throw them in jail. And this was less than 100 years ago. Though our state has really strong legal protections, we have a lot of work to undo in making sure that people, all people, not just people that live in counties where there's a clinic, can access care.
And what kind of lessons have you drawn from that? I mean, looking at history, that it can change?
Absolutely, it can. I mean, if I didn't believe it would change, I wouldn't do this work. You know, they'll call you a dreamer or they're going to call you whatever they are, but we change their point of view because we know that ultimately abortion is essential health care. It is our right to exercise bodily autonomy, and we are not going to stop exercising that right because politicians think they can legislate our bodies.
Sarah Michal Hamid, an abortion doula with the Los Angeles Abortion Support Collective. Sarah, thanks for coming on and talking with us about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate speaking with you as well.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, how community land trusts are trying to give people a piece of the American dream in ever-expensive L.A. That's tomorrow on GLA. Tell us what's on your mind. Even share a story idea with us at kcrw.com/GLA. And, of course, right there at the website, you can get the podcast as well. Juliana Mayo, Zeke Reed, Zoe Matthew, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all help put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time and, of course, your attention. Have a great night.